Well, this little section on technology has to do with audio engineering and production, first from Gary Gottlieb. Then Cassandra Gallego is going to talk about making discoveries from production data. And last, Rob Peretti will discuss audio processing with tools from CubeTech. I want to introduce Gary Gottlieb. He's an author and winner of an ARSC Award for Excellence, a recording engineer, live recordist, and music producer in New York, working with Grammy Award winners and Rock and Roll Hall of Famers. Gary worked as a critic, entertainment writer, and DJ. In 2002, he started teaching at Webster University, where he is now chair of the Department of Audio Aesthetics and Technology. Gottlieb, a member of AES, SPARS, APRS, ARSC, and the Recording Academy, tours frequently as a guest speaker. The common thread in Gary's career is quality, which was also the common thread in his research about changes in recording. Please welcome Gary Gottlieb.
Thank you, Bill, and after listening to that, I think the upshot is that I belong to way too many organizations. This is my first ARSC conference, and thank you all for having me. This has really been enlightening. It's really an interesting group, and you delve into some really interesting topics. I hope I can hold that up and carry the ball for the next 40 minutes. I would like to discuss the research leading up to this most recent book of mine and some of the surprises that I encountered along the way, and to me, what was the most thrilling part. The most thrilling part for me was the overall agreement among all these different audio professionals, producers, engineers, everyone I interviewed, live recordists, studio recordists, that the quality of our product was still the most important thing, always was, still is. How we get there has changed a little bit, but ultimately that goal is the same. I'd like to get through some basic information here and then move on to a little bit of support from the quotes that I got through the interviews and the research. And then, of course, take your questions at the end. So let's see if it actually is not advancing the slide here for some reason. I'm getting little dinging sounds that I'm hearing, but I'm not advancing for some reason. Okay. Let me just escape out of this and reload it very quickly, see if that helps. And there we go. Okay, first a moment to discuss the intent and really the impetus behind this project. There were a handful of people who really changed the nature of what an engineer did and created the modern job description for a recording engineer or music producer. These people were no longer just lab technicians, because for a long time, in the major studios at least, there were men in white coats. They were all men, they were all in white coats, and they wore ties under their lab coats, and all they did was look at meters and make sure that the voltage going through the circuit did not exceed the tolerances of the system, and they never actually listened to what they were doing. So what I endeavored to do in this, in context of what you do here, is you all archive the recordings. I was archiving the recordists. That was my goal, because there's just such a great wealth of knowledge out there, and I would hate to see that be wasted. Because what happened was, obviously we need to get these guys on paper while we still can. These new guys who came along, and when I say new guys, this was post World War II, right after World War II. Al Schmidt, Tom Dowd, Bill Porter down in Nashville. These people were actually listening. They were using their ears for the first time. They weren't just engineers who were looking at meters. They were actually listening to things. These were the guys that I needed to get down on paper. They started choosing different microphones, moving them around to better positions, instead of just accepting that the mic in the center of the room is the right way to do this, and whatever we get is what we get. They were more than just an accurate record of the performance. They were actually musical. And they were endeavoring to capture a musical performance from a musical piece rather than simply a snapshot of it. Whether you think the snapshot is the better idea or the musical thing is a better idea, this was the trend that gave rise to everything that we do now as engineers and producers in major studios. So they went on, which is the best part of all, to teach all the rest of us how to listen and how to place a microphone, how to choose a microphone, and how to communicate effectively with musicians so that we can get the best possible performance out of them, because this is something else that was not done previously. As a young audio professional in New York many years ago, I was acutely aware of who people like Tom Dowd were. And I was very much aware that Tom Dowd had mentored Phil Ramone, who had mentored Elliot Shiner, who had mentored Leslie Mona, who I was sitting behind while I was learning. So I felt like there was this very direct line there, and that some of those skills that were really created by people like Tom and Al Schmidt were being passed along, that I was receiving some of those. Sadly, some of these best mentors were starting to pass away. The rest of them are aging. I realized that I'd better get started on this project as soon as possible to ensure that I could open a door to the past for today's young audio professionals, the same way these same people had opened that door for me. And, you know, many of my students and many of the other young professionals I encountered just had no idea how to adapt to new equipment. They took what was in front of them and they were trained how to use that one piece, and then something else was put in front of them. They had no idea. The people I was talking to had new stuff put in front of them regularly. If not every day, then certainly every few weeks, a new piece of equipment that nobody had ever even heard of before was dropped in front of them. And they had to figure out how to not only use it, but how to use it well and how to make it benefit the final product. In addition to this knowledge that they had that I was afraid was starting to fade from our, you know, from our community, the mentoring system also has faded. The mentoring system that I came up through, where I started working in a recording studio, making the coffee, taking out the garbage, and cleaning the bathrooms, and I got to, my prize for doing all that for minimum wage was that I got to stand in the back of the control room and watch these amazing engineers work and absorb their knowledge. That system is all but gone now since the large studios have dwindled so much. So today's students and young audio professionals needed access to this wealth of knowledge. We needed a way to get this to them. So that really was the impetus behind this project. Jumping ahead a little bit, you know, this was basically the dedication in my book, or a truncated version of it. This book is dedicated to the engineers and professionals who shaped our passion and have passed on, and to those they have mentored. Their memories, their skills, their commitment to quality live on through those they have mentored, who have in turn mentored us all, because there is this very, very straight line down through the business. These are some of the audio luminaries whose passing inspired me to do this research while a wealth of information still existed about the gear and the methodology. Tom Dowd, I've mentioned already, his passing was really what gave me the kick in the butt to do this, because he was the New York engineer. He was the person who really changed our business in New York, where I grew up. So it was for him. But then really within a period of recent years, let's say, Les Paul, Wally Hyder, Alan Blumlein, John Ergel, Larry Levine, Bob Fine, whose son is a member of this organization, William Hoekstra, I mean, really so many of them. And then in addition to this list, there were some who I wanted to interview. Frank Lako from the church, on 30th Street. He had had a stroke, and he was really unable to be interviewed. We corresponded a little bit, and he said, I really can't do this. I can't speak for that long. Bill Porter, who was the Tom Dowd of Nashville, Studio B. He did all of the Elvis hits. He did so many great things. He and I have known each other for a long time. I worked with him in St. Louis for a time. Unfortunately, he was also just unable to. He passed away last year, but even before that, he was unable to be interviewed. So I really felt very deeply that, you know, the effect that this project was going to have, you know, based on what I had seen happening in recent years. So what I did was I went ahead and compiled a list of the most influential engineers and producers that I could think of. I contacted them. I contacted some other resources such as AES, the Historical Society, to find out, well, who's still alive from that era? Who's still, you know, if they're not still working, who's at least alive and still a resource for us? And I asked them for interviews. Now, most of them agreed to the interviews. I will say that in the interview process, I did have a very standard set of questions that worked beautifully, and then I also gave them a tremendous amount of latitude to talk about whatever they wanted to talk about, because I really wanted to get what their take was and what their information was and what they thought was important to pass along, rather than just what I thought. Now, my initial idea was we're going to talk a lot about equipment because we're all engineers, and even the producers came from an engineering background. So, you know, what was there when they started? you know, how they used gear, how they incorporated it, how it informed their art. These were all things that that I figured we would talk about, and we did talk about that to a degree. When I gave them the opportunity to talk about whatever they wanted, invariably, it came back to quality. And the bottom line is that the more things change, the more equipments change, formats change, the music business itself changes, the more our goals as audio professionals have stayed the same. So I asked the only natural follow-up question to this, which is, you know, what is quality in recording? What does that mean to you when you think about quality, when you talk about quality? The answers included the predictable things such as clarity, good spatial relationships, good depth, no noise, and of course, that certain something feel, whatever that is in that performance, that yes, that was the one. I know they were out of tune, but that was the one. As soon as we crossed that line of discussing quality, we were off talking about everything that's wrong with the music business today. Because how can you not jump from quality to what's wrong with everything? So what is wrong with the business today? Well, I know. Have you got a few days? I teach a class on what's wrong in the business today, and it takes me 16 weeks to explain it to students. I'm not going to go into all this, obviously. I also really want to mention right up front, it's not one person or one group's fault. And within each of these groups, there are some who want to do it right. Even Frauhofer at the bottom, the developer of the MP3, is out there trying to make a new and better digital format that's just as small and just as easy and just as convenient so that they can stop having all of us insult them so much. I think that's the real reason, but you know, they say the reason is they've just got to get a better format going. Either way, according to all the people I interviewed, people within all of these groups contributed to the overall downward trend in quality, which is what we are fighting in the business today and what every good engineer and producer is really battling against. Now, it's fun and easy to blame the big record companies for everything. We all love to do that. And we know that small labels are different. I want to make exceptions right here. There are some small labels who really are going out of their way to try to do it right. But the major labels, you know, especially following all the conglomeratization, if that's really a word, and all the consolidation, everything else, they are purely profit-driven. You know, there's the old story of, the whole loudness war is too much compression. Do we all know about that? That everything now that's coming out is just so heavily compressed. And the reason that I've heard from several record company executives is, well, they had no choice because the radio station sales forces were screaming at them, your records aren't reaching our tertiary, so we can't sell ads to people because somebody goes around that curve out in our tertiary, they lose the station, they change stations, and they're not going to hear the ads. So the radio station ad people all yell at the radio station music directors and program directors that they should only play things that are loud. And then they yell at the record company reps, we only want music if it's loud, that's the only thing we're going to play. And they yell at the A&R people, who yell at the producers, who yell at a lot of yelling going on about this. And the bottom line is that as engineers, we're all told you've got to compress it more. You've got to make it louder. We will only play it if it's louder. So the truth is that, yes, that is part of what happened, and that is a big factor in the loudness wars. There are other factors, like the fact that there's no budget for artist development anymore, and that album budgets have so fundamentally changed. Now, there may have been some flaws in the 70s and the early 80s when there were $250,000 record budgets. That might not have been the best system imaginable. But it's far worse now that they've shrunk to about 10% of what they were then. That big established bands who have followings, who will sell records, whatever that means these days, whether it's downloads or CDs or whatever it means, are only getting $20,000 or $25,000 if they're lucky to make a record. So you look at a band, a friend of mine records everything for the Eagles. They're a great example of this because they've sold a gazillion copies of everything that they put out, people buy. They were only given $25,000 to do their last record. And when they said, we can't go in a studio and do this for $25,000, they said, we'll just do it in Don's garage. He has Pro Tools. You can all just go to his garage and just do it there. We don't care. Nobody's going to buy the record anyway. Now, when they go out and play live, the Eagles charge $1.5 million for a live performance. So that's where they're making their money. So don't feel too sad for them. They're doing okay. But at the same time, this does hurt what is going to be recorded and what is eventually going to be archived from them. The product suffers because of the lower budget. And yes, this is very much, you know, in the record company's basket of what's wrong with the world right now. Moving along, artists are also partially to blame. They're led to believe that the technology is guiding their art rather than the other way around, which is really not a great way for them to think about it. It used to be that the band would practice in live venues, rehearsal spaces. They'd get really good at their tunes until they really knew what they were doing. Then they would come into the studio and they would play until they got a great take. And then they would go, wow, that was a great take. And then maybe they'd fix a couple little things in it and then they'd move on. Now, the trend is that each musician comes in individually. They play to a click track. Parts are time-aligned and fixed. In other ways, the singer comes in, does a couple of mediocre passes, and heads out to a club fully confident that the vocals will be auto-tuned and fixed and just sound fine. They'll sound okay. They will sound those dreaded words, good enough. We'll talk about good enough also, because that kept coming up in these interviews. They really are settling for adequate. Now, settling used to mean that we had an amazing take, which exceeded everyone's expectations, which made everyone go, wow, and the sax player or the singer, somebody was a touch off here or there in timing or in pitch. That used to be good enough. Now everything has changed in that. We used to pick them because the energy was right. Now we're settling for mediocre. And that's become the norm in these groups. And a lot of that has to do with the artist's expectations and the lowering of their expectations. This general attitude of good enough just has this horrible impact on us. We see it all throughout society. I mean, it's not just in our industry. We know that. That's why there's fast food restaurants on every corner, because we all want to eat good food, but this other stuff, well, it's good enough, and it's fast, and it's cheap, and that's why people go there. We see it in electronic gear of all types. And we're seeing it in music, where the convenience of having 6,000 songs in one's pocket — this is my phone, by the way, not an iPod. I don't own an iPod. But all my friends, including everyone, my wife, my daughter, everyone, they have these 6,000 songs on this little tiny thing they can put in their pocket, or more importantly, they have the capability for 6,000 songs. Very few people actually have that in their iPod. But they have that capability, and that's important to them. They have the convenience. It's small. It's easy. And that's much more important than the sound quality. And I have this discussion all the time with students of mine who know the difference. They understand what high-quality sound is. And even my family, who understands the difference but still choose to have the iPod. They all understand that they're settling for something that's good enough, but they're so thrilled with the convenience that they will do that. There is a secondary issue also in this whole good enough thing, which is the cultural shift in the group experience of listening to music. We're all aware of that. It used to be somebody would walk in the room with a new album and everybody would go, ooh, and we'd all sit there and listen to it and talk about it and critique it together. That experience on the youngest generation is now being lost, because they're listening to their music on earbuds. They're not listening over speakers anymore. This is a situation that I don't know how to correct, because this is really systemic. And then there's another issue, and I'm not even going to get started on this one. The whole hearing loss issue that's resulting from earbuds is a whole other thing. It's already been documented. This is not just guesswork on our parts. We know this is happening. So, oh, wait a minute. Was I on the wrong slide that whole time? How about that? Consumers. Okay, this is what I've been talking about. I didn't even switch the slide. Sorry about that. Okay, so now you know what you're supposed to be looking at while I was ranting on that. So let's talk about audio professionals. Young and old audio professionals alike, but mostly young audio professionals. We're all concerned about our clients. Those of us who are freelancers, we're all concerned about losing our clients and what we need to do, and we're all being pressured to do this. The young engineers are particularly susceptible to this pressure, especially when it comes from more experienced people, or people they believe are more experienced in the business. When their client has been a successful producer and they're being told by a successful producer, I want you to compress the hell out of this thing, then they're really nervous about not doing that. When a singer who's had a couple of albums out and they're a new engineer comes along and that singer says, yeah, go ahead and fix it. Go ahead and auto-tune it. I'm going to go get some dinner. Well, I'll be back in a couple of hours. You'll have it fixed by then, right? You know, it's hard for a young engineer to really stand up to that person. They feel more tentative about challenging their clients to do the right thing, although that's really what they have to be empowered to do. Young audio professionals are just not comfortable making these demands. They often feel fortunate just to have clients. If you're a young audio professional fresh out of college, you only have two clients, you're not going to really feel good about confronting one of them and really challenging them. But that's exactly what they need to do. Just we have to teach them to do that in the nicest possible way. they're not comfortable telling a band they have to play together. I mentioned before that the, you know, we used to do that all the time. That was standard. The band would practice a song. They'd learn how to play it together. They'd come in, they'd play it together. It was great. They'd keep doing it until it was good. Now, you know, they come in one at a time. And so how do you tell a band, no, I'll only work with you if you play together. And so can they do this? So the question is, what is the solution for all this for these young audio professionals? And how do we get them to fix this? And how do I get the slide to advance now? Yeah, that's what I'm doing. And it seems to have frozen, so I'm gonna very quickly go back. Yeah, don't you love it?
Yeah.
Okay, let's get back to about where we were here and see if I can make this. See, now you're getting the recap. Okay. And audio professionals. Oh, solution. There we go. With a question mark, because who knows? First off, get mentored. Whatever a student needs to do, if you know anyone going into this business, young audio professionals, young producers, aspiring producers, tell them to get out there and get mentored, whatever that means. Find a studio, no matter how small. Get behind somebody who knows what they're doing and watch them. We mimic this experience as best as we can. I'm fortunate enough to teach at a four-year university where we have them there for 4 years. It's long enough where we design classes that are similar to the mentorship experience. We then insist that they take an internship because they need to go out there and get the experience. They need to get the mentorship, and the internship might only be 3 months, but it's better than not mentoring at all, and it does mimic that experience. And we encourage them to talk to their clients in the nicest, most polite manner. Say, you know, that was good, but I think you might have a better take in you. How about we do another pass? You know, do what you can to try and draw that out of them, because that's really what you're going to need to do. Don't tell me it latched up again. This is getting a little disconcerting. Okay. I theoretically am, except now. Okay, there we go. Now it's going again. And really, the quotes are the best thing, and that's what's coming up next. So that's why I really want to get ahead to that. Okay, so are those readable out there? Okay, good. So according to all the people I interviewed, just really get them mentored in any way they can. Encourage them to spend more time. This is what this is all coming down to. And have them try and talk to their clients to sway them in the right way. And really, you've heard me now ranting about everything that's wrong in the business and all this for 10, 15 minutes, whatever it's been. This is what came out of the research. Okay, these are the people who are actually out there doing this. They're seeing everything that's wrong in the business, and they're the ones who are telling me what's wrong in the business. That's where I've drawn all of this from. Ed Cherney, great engineer, works out here in LA. Having a band in a studio that could really play their instruments, having a large format analog console and a big machine with the red light going on, and these guys had to play a complete take through the song. That was what I wish I had now. Those are skills. It was just fun being the cats and making the music like that. It was always a case for the whole being greater than the individual part. Everybody brought something to the party, and you would make these really great, timeless records. This is what we're talking about, getting them all in the studio, all to play together. Chuck Ainley from down in Nashville, another great engineer. I'm going to say that's for every one of these. They're all great engineers, or they're great producers, so I'll stop saying that. But Chuck Ainley, the technology keeps changing, but I don't know that we're making any better records. You can go back, a Led Zeppelin or a Beatles record, those still sound wonderful even by today's standards. And they're so creative, and they're warm, and they're musical. With having all these plugins and capacity to tune things, I think it just makes the performers weaker. They don't actually strive to get a take from one end to the other. Again, exactly what we've been talking about. Frank Filippetti from New York, yet another great engineer. I actually, one of my first gigs in New York was assisting Frank. That's why I particularly like having him in here. The current, and he's, by the way, was one of the first engineers to really jump on digital technology, which is why this is even more telling. The current digital technology that we have is the highest resolution audio, the best sounding audio that the consumer has ever had for the least amount of money. Unfortunately, we're also compressing and smashing and doing all that. What I wish, it's the mindset that yes, this Walkman or this iPod or whatever it is very convenient, really great to listen to while I'm jogging or doing my homework, but tonight I'm going to get into listening to this on a great system, under great conditions, and really experience music in a way that other way is never going to give me. So I say it's a mindset that I wish I had today. I wish I had the gear of today with the mindset of the 70s and 80s. And this is something I heard from so many people, that it's just the way consumers are listening, the way we're smashing it with all the compression, the way the consumers are listening to that as a result, all of this combines to create this really big problem. And the sound quality potentially is better than ever. But we're just not doing it right. Then this is a problem. Elliot Shiner, another New York engineer, he mentored with Phil Ramone. He was then went on to a brilliant career of his own, 23 Grammy nominations, I believe, at last count, and 8 wins. He also grew up about 5 blocks from me, although we didn't know each other then. We figured that out later. I'd like to talk about the MP3 issue and trying to bring back quality, and the organization that I'm with, Meta, and how we're trying to make people and young engineers more aware of quality recordings and higher resolution formats that are available. We're trying to get educators and teachers that are teaching courses and training these younger engineers to hold with us on all these issues. So I always want to keep that at the forefront. We're also working with manufacturers who feel who we feel put out high quality products that are not selling out. So again, these people are upholding the quality. They're in a position where they can. You know, Elliot Shiner is a top-notch engineer. People pay a lot of money to work with Elliot. So if Elliot says, or a George Massenberg, or a Phil Ramone says to a client, you really need to learn how to play this together, go learn how to play this song together and then come back and we'll record it, they'll do that for these guys. Whereas the new student fresh out or anyone who's desperate for work might not. I'm fortunate personally in that I do all these other things, like, you know, I teach at Webster University and run the program and I write books. So I only do a couple of albums a year now. So I'm able to pick and choose a little bit more. You know, I understand this idea of any client, you've got to keep them, you've got to do whatever you can from all my years in New York. But I'm in a fortunate position now where if a band comes to me, I say, okay, well, I'm happy to work together, but I'm not going to auto-tune anything of yours, and you have to play together. We're going to go to a rehearsal studio somewhere. We're going to listen to you guys play. We're going to work out all the things. Then we're going to come in the studio, we're going to play together. And a lot of them get like scared as hell from that, because this is just terrifying to them, that that they would actually have to go into the studio like that and actually play the instruments. And then invariably what we get is an amazing take. They keep doing it, and then they come in the control room and they listen and they go, wow, we got them to exceed their expectations. That's what we need to be doing to retain quality in our product. I'm told I have about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to do about one more quote, because this is a particularly good one. Paul Stubblebine from San Francisco, great mastering engineer. What's happening is, get an okay performance, think that you fix a few things, it'll be a good performance. It isn't. It's an okay performance with fixes. I'm not going to read the whole thing. That's really the gist of it. Oh, okay. Well, then let me get through just the gist of a few of these others then, because that's really the gist of what he says here is really what I was just saying, the same thing. And these are the people who this comes from. Gary Chester, a New York engineer, did a gazillion jingles, millions of jingles, Broadway scores, things like that. And prior to that, before he got into the commercial end of the business, he did albums for some artists. And the same thing, you know, he'll work with all these old school musicians and, you know, they'll come in and they'll play together and they'll go, you know, wow, it's been so long since we got to see each other, you know, because they all come in one at a time and play. And the energy of those performances is just so much better. And that's what all these guys are missing in today's performance. Alan Parsons, who recorded Dark Side of the Moon, worked at Abbey Road when the Beatles were working there, of course, went on to his own career as the Alan Parsons Project. Talking about compression on Dark Side of the Moon, which people are sometimes surprised to hear that it was compressed. The reason is that he didn't compress the drums. So the drums still have that big, open, live sound. Everything else is compressed. And just because of him insisting that the drums not be compressed, it kept that and it retained that quality, that big, open quality. And I'm probably about at the point... I should probably be looking at a watch myself, but I don't have one, so... this is Gene Eichelberger from down in Nashville. Whatever was on the console is what you had. This is just a great quote, just because I love the fact that it was like, whatever they threw at us, we dealt with it. Whatever they gave us. If you had EQ, yeah, maybe you used it. If you didn't have it, you didn't use it. But the point is, you can do whatever you want to do just by choosing the right mic, placing the mic correctly, moving the musicians around it where they needed to be, instead of having to go through this thing that the students do now, which is they record it, and then whatever they get in from their original choice of mic and their original placement, they try and just reach and fix it with EQ. I call it ass-in-seat syndrome. And I try and break my students from ass-in-seat, like, get your ass out of the seat, get it out in the studio, and go move mics around instead of trying to fix it with equalization. And they understand that, and they do learn that. So at this point, are there any questions? Yes.
As far as the decline of mentorship for new audio professionals, I'm wondering, I guess, about the role you see for networked ways of sharing information over the internet. You know, I know that audio professionals contribute to online forums and mm-hmm. things like that. So if you're not receiving information, you know, solely from a mentor or mentee kind of communication, about the role of communication across a network of a generation mm-hmm. of new audio professionals.
Yeah, I think the information that you can share over the internet is incredibly valuable, especially with people who you know and who you trust. I also think that the other side of that coin is that there's a ton of information on the internet, and maybe 10% of it is accurate and correct, and the rest of it is not. And I invariably have students who come into the studio and they say, I'm going to do this mic on the top and this mic on the snare, because I just read on the Gear Sluts this morning that that's what, you know, John Bonham did to get that big sound. It's like, no, it's ears. If you had ears like that, you could do this. It's not about the microphone. And they don't really get that. So there's an upside and a downside to it. And just to take that one step further, there are a lot of online programs now. And I know that everyone who wants to learn audio or production will find the right way to do it. And for some of them, online programs are right. But I think there are some real problems with not being physically in a room with somebody who is expert at it, who can really walk you through what needs to be done. I think it's very challenging. I don't think it's really possible to do that online.
Gary, we've got 5 minutes, so go ahead.
Yes.
I just kind of have a comment and a question. I get a little concerned at this conversation about the idea that young musicians today aren't bringing anything to the table and aren't working collaboratively. I mean, mm-hmm. Let me just say my piece, yeah. And then I'm because I think that this is happening really on a grassroots level. There are a lot of musicians that I know that are incredible musicians that know how to work with recording equipment that are doing it themselves because mm-hmm. they don't have the money to get into these big studios, because the way that studios have grown and changed, mm-hmm. it doesn't provide the forum for smaller bands. And so I just get concerned that we're assuming that everybody is moving towards the MP3 and the iPod way of listening to things. And I think I'm part of a contingent of young people mm-hmm. that are agreeing with things you're saying.
That's great.
And not of that opinion. And so I just wanted to, say that I didn't want it to be across the board.
Thank you.
You know?
I'm making broad generalizations here, and you're absolutely right. There is a contingent of young people who understand this and who are moving in that right direction. And I think that the democratization of the recording process and the demystification of it, the fact that anyone can have Pro Tools, and if they work with it enough, they can get pretty good with it, is good. I think that most of the best people I know in the movement that you're describing do a lot of their work at home and then come to a trained engineer to finish their product so that they get the best possible product. But no, I'm with you. I've been making broad generalizations here, and I apologize, because I don't mean to say that there is nobody out there looking at quality, because there definitely are some. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah.
And thank you for being one of those.
Gary, that was more or less what I wanted to bring up. That was a good point, I think, an important point to make, and especially today, mm-hmm. Not politically really popular to be in favor of our great new tools, and not politically necessarily very popular to be in favor of the great advantages of digital technology over the old status with vinyl and with the analog tape and all that. I think part of your presentation strikes me a little bit like the old gray guys going, you're not doing it like we did it. Damn it.
It's hard not to give that impression with this.
Well, I mean, that I think that's a lot of what's going on. And I think the phrase you just used is one I've been using as well, but since the 70s, which is the democratization of the recording process.
Yeah.
And I really think that in many, I'm an engineer and producer, and I work all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And my name is Joe Weed, W-E-E-D.
Joe.
Yeah, a little personal plug there, joeweed.com. I think that, you know, what I've seen is many of the people that I exchange files with over the internet or send tapes or send, you know, media around with, the best session players in the country are, virtually all of them have studios in their own, in their homes or in their offices, and can do very professional level work that way. Mm-hmm. And it looks to me like, I'm thinking a lot of these university programs and community college programs, and it would probably be hard to make it happen in the professional schools, but in those too, I think that they should be preparing musicians for doing the kind of thing that you're almost complaining about, which is, and what you were just mentioning, is to become very effective working in their homes, in their garages, in their bedrooms, and in their offices with Pro Tools or some other. You know, I mean, Pro Tools is ubiquitous. I love it. We use it all the time. It takes, it just totally obviates a million problems in the
thing. I'm a Nuendo fan myself.
But you know, and one other last little bit here about the old gray guys, when we complain about things, they're just not doing it the way that we used to do it. A lot of those huge budgets, you know, those $250,000 budgets, were there because of, not because that's what the band deserved and needed to record, but because you'd had to spend the money to buy all the drugs, to bail the guys out. Now, this is serious, this is true, to buy all the food, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. And making a lot of albums, you know, you mentioned several that certainly were made that way. People were, professional mm-hmm. musicians came in prepared for a session.
Right.
But you know, a lot of those sessions, a lot of those great albums were made over a period of many weeks and months because they didn't know what the hell they were doing, and those bands came into the studio with nothing ready.
That happened too, and some of them did take years to make. Now, just to address your other point very, very quickly, because I know I'm being moved along here. First off, we are talking about engineers and producers, not necessarily musicians. And while most every engineer and producer I know is a musician, that is not their goal, to be a professional musician. Their goal is to be a professional engineer or producer. And there is a slight difference. Now, these people, at least in my school and really in any quality institution I know, are being trained for any eventuality. So they're being trained on Pro Tools, Nuendo, Logic, Samplitude, as well as on, you know, an M79 for those of us like my school who are fortunate enough to have one. So they're learning tape, they're learning analog, they're also learning digital, they're learning how to do things with people in multiple locations, they're learning how to take tracks that have been started at home and then finish them in the studio. They are learning all these different possibilities.
One more question and a quick answer.
Well, I just wanted to point into another direction about what you were, basically George Lucas in the 70s as compared to now. Like, mm-hmm. he had a lot of limitations to deal with in the 70s, and he made it work. Whereas now, he's basically what you just said, ass in seat syndrome. I mean, he just directs from and looks at a green screen. And I mean, I find it inspiring that you're saying, like, you're telling us, you know, the up-and-comers to, like, look at what you have and do what you can with it instead mm-hmm. of, you know, GAS, gear acquisition syndrome,
and use
your ears and have your ears shape what you do instead of just mm-hmm. you know, your purchases. And I'm very glad that that's the case, and I'm just happy. And I mean, I work with the Cylinder Digitization Project at UCSB, and it's mm-hmm. it's great to see that how the limitations of our recording medium shaped how we recorded. And now that we can do anything, mm-hmm. like, we don't know what to do with it.
Too many options.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's Too Many Options is another seminar I give to students. That's the title of another one that I do sometimes.
Great job, Gary. Well, thanks a lot.